Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Gifted Place, a professional learning community for gifted education. I'm your host, Sonu Aziz. We're talking today with Dr. Lynn Lim, Dean of Students and Communications at Bridges Graduate School of Cognitive Diversity and Education and author of C is for Curiosity. Dr. Lim is a founding member of the Texas-based nonprofit Gifted Education Family Network, GEFN, which focuses on gifted families and supports gifted education in public schools. She is currently the president of the National Board of Directors for SENG, in addition to serving on the board of pgretreat.org and Gifted Homeschoolers Forum. Welcome, Dr. Lynn Lim.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to bright and early in California. I'm saying hello, and we have an interesting conversation coming up.
Such an impressive portfolio of accomplishments in gifted education, but you didn't start out in that direction. What motivated you to go from studying economics and environmental studies to human development and education?
My interest and degree is in human development psychology. My specific focus at that time is on attitudes and beliefs and how that interacts with our behavior. So it's really, again, very narrow portion of it. So, you know, through my own journey as a parent, you know, it really sparked my interest back again, but now from a more of a developmental twist to all those areas. I was motivated because of the challenges I faced personally, advocating for the needs of my two children. They have very different needs. We were in public school. I always believed in public school. I still believe that we can do it. There's some, we need to just think creatively about it in terms of how we can nurture all types of learners. So kind of through my own experience, I went, oh, I wonder what it's like being an educator, you know, on the other side. I did teach while I was a doctoral student. I think that was a very long time ago under very different conditions that was undergraduate students. So I became a substitute teacher at our public school district for 2 years so that I could have some experience of what it feels like a little bit from an educator's perspective. So, you know, through all of that experience, I really felt deeply that the current education system that we have, when it's, you know, any education system, when it's designed for the masses, it's not going to be appropriate for all types of learners because it's designed, the outer limits already precludes the outliers.
You have two profoundly gifted children. Your son is twice exceptional. He's gifted with autism. What did their educational environment look like at home and in school? And were you always able to keep them challenged and curious?
What I would call a home educational environment. So we've always, besides my daughter for 1 year when she did homeschooling, we've always been in some sort of schooling environment. So that's more structured. And then at home, what I would consider our educational environment would be called flip learning. So I really see myself as a facilitator, and my job is to open my children's eyes to what's out there in the world and really let their curiosity drive the next step. So when they go beyond curiosity into interest, or if I sense that, or if they tell me like, hey, you know, or something about our interaction indicates that, then I kind of look into how I can go more deeply, bring resources or connect them or go somewhere. If I don't know anything about a topic, that's what I would do. So really more of a facilitator type of role with them. And with curious minds, they are often seeking to learn and really to ask, to wonder. And then that, on the flip side, does make finding appropriate learning environments that dynamically adapt to their, what I would call neurology, biology, psychology, and physiological growth over time really challenging. So it's a constant balance and assessment and readjustment. So it's, if you think about it, it's like a dynamic, complex system. So anything in one component that changes, be it, you know, physical growth, because my kids are growing, impacts the whole system. So that's the challenge that I face.
Research shows that when non-autistic people, they find it hard to understand autistic people, they form negative mental judgments about them when they meet them for the first time. Did you ever experience that? And can you describe a time when you felt your son may have been judged because he wasn't understood?
So in our case, and that's adding on to another layer of complexities for twice exceptional learners like my son, he was since young, when people meet him, overall, the first impression people get is his giftedness. So in our case, we didn't have him diagnosed till he was 9. So we actually faced the reverse type of negative experience where people would go, how could he be? Or, you know, like, or when he says certain things, he's like, he's quite literal, even though he's very bright, certain things he's very literal. And you'd be like, what do you mean by that? Or do you mean, you know, something? People take it to be like, oh, you're just trying to be funny, you know, because you're bright. Like, don't you get it? So the type of challenges we face are the reverse side where they think he's, you know, trying to be not funny, but, you know, difficult. Like, you totally get it. Like, why are you asking? But he really doesn't. And he would say, he'd be like, I'm very literal. And, you know, and the way he would say things, it's very matter of fact. And that's sometimes it's often difficult for people to tell, like, how serious are you? Mm-hmm. Because he would say things in a really, I would say, you know, pretty calm way and matter of fact. Yeah. And then it's difficult then without more variation in tone and things like that to really tell, are you joking or not? Or so it requires a little bit more interest and also curiosity on the other person's side to go, wait a minute, you know, especially when I would be in a conversation with him after 5 minutes, I'm like, wait a minute, something's not quite right. And then when I clarify and I forgot, you know, I keep wanting to try to recall that particular conversation, like, what do you mean by something? You know, mm-hmm. a term I use, his interpretation of it is technically also correct, just not the common way. Right. So then because he was coming from that interpretation of certain words, we were having a almost like parallel conversation versus one conversation. Mm-hmm. It felt weirder and weirder. And because, you know, I'm comfortable and he's comfortable, like, wait a minute, what's going on? And we kind of like had to rewind back. Mm-hmm. And I would say in general, that's type of opportunity and level of interaction is going to be difficult in a large setting when you have a lot of students and you have teachers, different teachers every year, or, mm-hmm. you know, you just don't have enough interaction with each child to maybe know them enough, all these subtle nuances. So those are the, you know, challenges and personal experiences we've gone through.
The double empathy problem is a theory that describes when autistic and non-autistic people struggle to understand each other. What was your communication dynamic?
So, yeah, that's a very important question and also a very complicated question because our interaction has obviously changed over time. So when he was younger, I don't know why or how, but somehow I was able to understand without even knowing myself how, you know, like his needs and stuff, but he was not able to communicate his needs to me, like what he wanted me to know. So we actually taught him basic sign language, not more for basic needs, like eating more, whatever. Once he was able to communicate at that younger age, I noticed that it was a big relief for him. Like, he was less frustrated. His frustration really seemed to come from him not being able to get out what's in his head to somebody else. So he has all these things he wanted to, I don't know, say or communicate, but he couldn't get it out in a way we understood. A, he didn't have language yet at that. You know, that's why we ended up teaching him sign language, right? So once he was able, like, at that time was like food or whatever, it was like we saw a huge jump, you know, like in the quality of, you know, mm-hmm. not just communication, just in general. And then when he started talking, it was a whole other level again. So it seems to be, instead of maybe more gradual type of changes in our communication experience, it always seems to be more like steps, like ladder steps. You know, it just jumps suddenly, depending on developmentally for him. That seems to be key feature of our communication, meaning him A, being able to speak, then, you know, and then being able to speak and also being able to find words that really reflect his inner feelings. I think that's a whole other level. And I don't think it's because he's autistic. We all struggle with that, but because he's gifted and autistic, he wanted to find really precise words to express emotions, which is really not precise. I think that's really in his case, the conflict and the struggles that we have. He really wanted to express something that's really difficult to quantify, and we really don't have good words linguistically to be that precise. And that's the struggle I see in terms of his communication in particular. Like I said, if you meet one autistic person, it's just one. Besides that, things like, especially metaphorical language, he'll be like, why would, you know, like, don't cry over your spilled milk. And then he'll be like, why would you do that? Right. And it's like, okay, when you think about it from a very rational, logical mind, it's like, yeah, why would you do that? However, what we did was we ended up turning it into, let's figure out, because at some point, you know, let's figure out the why behind why those terms came up. And then, you know, that helped him to understand better, but also he just needed a explicit, like, decoding. Almost like a decoding manual, because he doesn't think that way. But once you explain it, he gets it, like, right away, moves on. That's it, you know. So, you know, for him, it's difficult to say. I want to say it's more the gift of time. When people give you time in an interaction to know each other, whether you're autistic or not, or the combination, you know, you could get to a common ground. I think it's more finding time to get to a common ground. That's the challenge.
Able to get the support and the time that he needed to be able to communicate in school, like, were his teachers able to kind of think of, you know, unique ways or creative ways to try to draw that out?
So I think within the school setting, it depends on the topic. So in terms of the regular academic topics, there's not as many, obviously, metaphorical type things going on. So the interaction seems to be the teacher's way of explaining material. If for teachers that are using a lot more metaphorical language, it would be, in general, sort of, it takes him more, he needs to translate it more in his mind. And if he doesn't know it, depending, he will ask, he'll put his hands up and ask questions. So if the teacher's like, we don't have time for that, or don't you know about it type of thing, then, you know, for him, again, it's the relationship. Even if he doesn't know something and the teacher's not able to have time, let's say if it's a very intense class and you have to, you know, a lot needs to be covered, how the teacher reacts to him from a relational point really makes a difference to him. Even if she can't address the questions that he has, if she's saying it like, oh, we don't have time for it right now, versus like, stop interrupting the class, that to him makes the difference in terms of. So in school, in terms of the typical things that are discussed in school, it's not that, you know, it's not that much in his case of a struggle. He knows all the rules. The thing seems to be in the moment when a particular situation happens. How do you interact socially? That tends to be the part that needs to be debriefed and sort of like, almost like, okay, let's, you know, like, let's rewind and go back and do that. So that's the support we needed in our case, not the rules per se, because he does know them. In fact, the feedback we got was because by the time we'd gone through and gotten an IEP and everything, we were in middle school. The feedback from which was the flip side, the challenge we have is that the service level we were able to access wasn't the right level he needed. He really needed, if there is such a thing, social cues, sessions, that's really at least the high school, if not beyond level. So the feedback we got was, he's great. He's teaching all the other students
But again, was he getting what he needed?
He wasn't. And which is why we had exited out the public school. And I don't blame the school, because what he needed wasn't accessible, because the resources they had was, oh, you're in middle school, so you get middle school stuff, at least in our, you know, and that's not what he needed because he knows that, you know, the specific skill sets he needed wasn't accessible at that level for him.
So in our experience, what ended up happening was just in a very short, we were in public school till second grade. That's when we found out that he's twice exceptional. So that was the beginning of our journey. So in third grade, we went to, because at that time, I knew something was off, but I couldn't, we were still trying to figure out what it is. The only thing at that time, based on our psychoeducational assessment, was that it was just a large discrepancy, you know, between the highest and lowest scores. And also I noticed his handwriting, you know, that he was having difficulty. And so he was dysgraphic. So that was all we knew at that time. So, but I knew logically, right? If you are both, right? If you are gifted and you have some challenge and you have challenges, both areas has to be addressed simultaneously in order for things to work. You can't just only address one and ignore one or whatever way it is. So in our school district at that time, we had requested for an assessment for possible special ed inclusion because he, again, the outside presentation was he's a bright child and yeah, his handwriting is messy. Sure, he has dysgraphia, but we can just teach him how to use the keyboard. And no, so we were declined to even be assessed for special education at that time. So to me, it's like, well, if we're not even going to investigate that, we really couldn't stay at our public school because, again, intrinsically, you need the two sides to be addressed. So we went to a private gifted school at that time in third grade because at that time, we didn't know that there might be anything else going on with that. So that's what happened. And then we came back after third grade. We continued doing our different types of assessment. And at the end of third grade, after investigating a lot of other things, you know, I had considered that perhaps he might be autistic at some point, but we really needed all the other pieces to come in before it made sense to really go, perhaps this is the next step to do. So that's what we took the whole year to do that. And then at that point, with all the data we have back in public school, they also agreed that, okay, it looks like perhaps we do need to do this. And that they had then finally agreed to do an assessment for special education. And so that's how we kind of ended up with, you know, formally diagnosing that he is autistic, you know, on there. And then what happened then after that was, as I explained, you know, the services wasn't considerate of him, A, as a whole person. It seemed to be very, okay, if you are X, you know, it's sort of addressing very separate parts of him. But when the separate parts interact as a whole person, that consideration and needs are different. So it's sort of, that's our struggle there. So in fifth grade, so we stayed fourth grade and then, you know, it was a difficult year to advocate for him. And then by the time, you know, how long it takes to do this and that, you know, like check off all the whatever checklist we need to do was like the end of the year. So we went, okay, let's try fifth grade. You know, like, you know, it was a different team, different school, physical school. When I had visited with him, they seem to have a lot of experience. Like, oh yeah, we know this type of children and we have a lot of experience. No worries. You know, I'm like, okay, great. Let's try that. Fifth grade in the first semester. And that's also when I started being a substitute teacher too within our district. So I asked him, you know, what's one thing you learn? I just asked for one thing you learn in school. He said nothing. You couldn't tell me one new thing, just one little. So when I got that feedback and he said it, you could tell like he's intensely curious, but you could just see his eyes and everything. He's just like shutting down. So that's when we exited out public school for him, but I still continue to be involved in groups that really want to make a change in public school. I think that's really important because change has to happen in all levels, public, private, at home, and all of that. But that's very telling because you can actually not only sense, but see that parts of him just shutting down.
How do you think his understanding of his giftedness impacted his own expectations of what he was trying to achieve or his self-esteem.
So during those times within the public school, he would come home after we had some support in place. He would come home one day and say something like, "Oh, I'm with the people who can't write" group or something. Well, I didn't say that. We didn't say that in our family. So where are you getting that message from? Whether it is implicit or explicitly said, that's what he's feeling. And because thank goodness he happened to say it. I'm like, "Oh, who said that?" Or he's like, "Oh yeah, I'm with that." You know, I wasn't in the classroom, so I'm not able to say, but kids with high cognitive ability, they think about things deeply, and they really, you know, maybe other things that are said, they don't just go in one ear and out one ear. They really think about it. They could not think about it. So something, he's getting messages in school like that. And because he thinks very differently, different doesn't mean it's, you know, if you think differently, that's not equated to like whether you're gifted or not. I mean, you know, everybody thinks differently to some extent, but the messaging he's getting seems to be there is a particular image of what it means to be gifted within the environment that we were in. Not that all environments are like that, but that's the messaging he was getting. And basically he started saying like, "I'm dumb." He actually said that. That's what he there. And then after we've left, I've never seen him say that. He's never been ill trying to go to school. In fact, what he said was, "When is school starting up again?" Like, you know, right. So again, finding the environmental right impacts, you know, although I knew about the importance of environmental impacts, the extent for some students is astonishing. Like, I've been really underestimating, even though I was more sensitized to environmental context and how that interacts with us as human beings. I was blown away at the extent of how different, like if I described him at the gifted school or at this school or at that school or whatever the environment is, you're going to say, "You're describing five different children." And I'll be like, "No, it's the same child." You know, and he couldn't have changed that much between, you know, like the, you know, that school, and like if it's right after each other. Yes, he grew, you know, matured, but still, it was astonishing.
Anything else aside from relationships as a key factor that would impact that environment?
So other things within the environment could be, you know, he has sensory sensitivity. So if we pay attention to not just when we talk about environments, not just the relational, but also including things like physical environment of the classroom, which can be, again, if we pay attention to it, it doesn't necessarily have to cost like tons of money for him, because he is very observant and curious. He can tell you before he could settle down to do the classwork, he will notice whatever's on the walls around the classroom. So any change you make on that, somehow it captures his attention. So, you know, if you have a very tight classroom, you're like, "Yeah, we got to do like 5,000 things." For a child like that, he can't even settle down, because I think he just can't help it. Once he walks in, he'll notice somehow, you know, it's like, "Oh, that thing's different. Oh, why is that different? And, you know, why is this different?" And he would tell me, he would know, and he would even notice, you know, the teacher's hair is straight today, and it, you know, whatever, cut her hair. I mean, yes, it's probably obvious, but, you know, I'm not sure how many kids may pay that much attention or would know about it. He would comment to the teacher like, "Oh, your hair is straight today," or something like that. I mean, that's, you know, it's right. Just things like that, that again, not that that's great, but sometimes that gets in the way of the task at hand. So if you have students like that, can we think about a way where we can minimize distractions when there isn't any purpose to it? So there's sort of certain things that are within our control within a classroom environment that we could do. Yeah, maybe a space for quiet space for students that need that, you know, space aside, downtime or something like that. The whole point is for them to feel safe. Like it's a safe environment. It's not even right that relationship is part of it too, but the safety part, a lot of the signals for it is nonverbal. So it's what's in the classroom physically, you know, the layout, the you know, if it's like really harsh lighting or something like that, all signals our body that is dangerous or something like that. So beyond relations, a lot of these could be, you know, we could think about how can we promote that.
Right. Or creating even a space where they can be creative, where they can go and explore something. Did he ever have anything like that in school?
The private schools, I mean, the public schools, no, the private schools are a lot more conducive to something like that. For him, again, because his interests are in general quite different from like whatever the themes are and all that. So that's another whole challenge for him. Like at one point in, you know, at 8 years old, he was intensely interested in ants. I'm not sure ants would be part of a regular curriculum or something like that. Although what you could probably do is leverage that intensity interest in ants into, I don't know, history or something if possible.
Or science, right.
Oh, science, you know, as possible. So I think that finding the fit between what he happens to be really interested in, and in 9 years old or 10 years old, he was intensely interested in World War II, which we didn't touch upon till like last year or the, you know, something like that. And by then he's already been there, done that. So, you know, although he did, you know, kind of share his, like in that case, what the teacher did, which I thought was interesting, was because he already have that body of knowledge, it was then appropriate for him to gain the other skill set, which is for him to present it like a, you know, but not all the time. The whole point, I think, that we end up doing is if it's appropriate for one situation, we don't just have him do it for every single class. Then he's not, you know, it really depends. So he enjoyed being sort of like the teacher's helper, but also the expert or the mini expert for that particular module. So it's not even the whole class, just that module. So that was interesting. Yeah.
C is for curiosity is a beautiful and funny photo journey told through the eyes of your son. It aims to provide a starting point for a meaningful dialogue with children about being curious about the world around them. And it immediately connects with the reader. There's really great pictures and relatable photos of your son finding joy in a seashell, turning a plastic bag into a backpack, and making a foil sculpture garden. What was your inspiration for telling the story through the lens of a child?
We decided to make this book for several reasons. You know, one is to really remind adults and parents that, you know, curiosity is really part of who we are naturally from birth. And, you know, because I find myself, because we're just bogged down and caught up in all the what's going on, that, you know, we feel like we have lost that sense of curiosity. So that's so one reason, for several reasons. One is to kind of remind us, especially for parents looking for a book to interact with our children, that through that interaction, it really reminds us that we really should, A, find time, right, to continue building this, allowing us to have the space to be curious, because we all have it. It's, I think part of it is that lack of time and also not building it as a value into our daily living. And if that's important, we have to consciously kind of create our living around allowing this to emerge. And then the other thing is sort of also to share for readers to get a glimpse of the inner world and experience of someone that they may be able to relate to or not. And also use that as a basis to dialogue about how everyone's experiences are different. We do all vary in how we experience our world. We're not robots. So, you know, that variation, whether it's a large variation or a little variation, is really very enriching. And having the using the book as that dedicated space to really talk about, right? Using the book as multi-purpose, because it's like, okay, we're learning something, we're doing something educational. And also then this is our dedicated time to really talk about, to exchange the different experiences. That's also allowing that communication piece to come in, especially, I think, very differently from both my children, really. My older daughter, we think more similarly, but still very different in our styles and how we experience things. And so that's the sort of main two reasons for really wanting to share that. And then last but not least is that I wanted to see more children's books around topics like, you know, curiosity and like positive things. And also to share as an Asian American, you know, we wanted more books that sort of looks like our children in our case, so that they could go, oh, wait, this looks like kind of like me and sort of or not and go, oh, but I have the same experience. I love looking at a seashell. Like, how wonderful is that?
Do you feel that being an Asian American associated with 2E or anything, sometimes it's considered taboo to even speak something like that? Do you, have you ever experienced something like that? Or is it something like, okay, it's neurodiverse, you know, we all need to just celebrate who we are as individuals and look past kind of these stereotypes that have been holding back communities for so long?
Yeah, I think you really hit the nail right on its head, that the reason why I'm sharing our story is very difficult, because culturally it's difficult to share anything that could be perceived as negative. We kind of tend to keep that sort of like the in general, we tend to have the, you know, there's certain cultural norms in terms of what's okay to share with the world, and then what's so-called not okay to share with the world that you keep within your family. And that tends to be anything that's negative or not. And by sharing our story, A, we're showing that they are, you know, being gifted and having some challenges. It cuts across all different race, everybody, right? Like everybody, you're going to find somebody that is what we is called twice exceptional. And that really, you know, can we still find, and I think we can, you know, what are some common grounds across, cutting across, right? I'm not talking about this because I'm Asian American. I really wanted to talk about it to show that all of us have children, you know, can and probably do have children across all humanity that are diverse in different ways, in many different ways. And what are some common grounds we could allow us to come together to share our different experiences, or perhaps even very similar experiences, to get beyond, you know, all those boxes were being put in and the stereotype and sort of like, oh, you must be, you know, X because or whatever on there. So that's, you know, a reason why I try to actively be involved, but also to share our personal journey. Because it's one thing to say, oh, you should do it. But it's another thing to go, I'm doing it because I want to be open about it. There's nothing wrong with it. It's sort of, there are many strengths in, you know, if there are supports we need, we seek it. And then, you know, how can we then nurture the strengths? Because all of us are different. It's just we're different in different ways.
Do you think writing it with the hopes of understanding the world from a child's perspective helped you better understand and identify your son's struggles and challenges in addition to his strengths and talents?
Yeah, and that's why I did include, I think, one of the pages in there, you know, he did an artistic interpretation of how difficult dysgraphia writing is for him. We're not saying when you focus on strength that you ignore the challenges. We're saying we need to consider it, be considerate of both sides, because those are realities that they do. They are significant, you know, complex challenges that they need to overcome. But that shouldn't get in the way. How can we be it bypass or support that and look at really the bigger picture? Is we want to move to a positive place in total. How do we do that? We do that by not ignoring the strengths or not only focusing, you can't just only focus. Like, when you have limited time, what's the best use of your time when you want to move towards a positive space? Is it important, for example, my son still, he could play the violin, which I think is so difficult because I learned it as an adult. I'm like, oh my God, that's so hard. You know, somehow it came easily to him. But he has a very difficult time tying his shoelace, and he still does today. And I mean, we have tried, you know, probably not as intensely as other people, but, you know, I started out thinking more like, that's a basic thing. We should all learn how to tie shoelace. And then as I started scaling back, when I zoomed myself out and look at a bigger picture and the longer, like, throughout the lifespan type of perspective, I'm like, okay, how important is it to know how to tie your shoelace when you're talking about the big picture? And then we're like, you know what? Not that important. You could wear laceless stuff. There's so much stuff now for it. So then that helped me and helped him and all of us to feel like, A, we've considered the different challenges very seriously, you know, and had a conversation. How does that fit in the larger picture, you know, and of where we are and in our place and time in right now? Meaning, if my son was born during the time when writing was the only way to communicate besides speaking, then we would have spent more time, for example, you know, but nowadays he actually said, Mom, I don't really need to write. I can just type. And I was still stuck initially in the, no, we got to like, you know, do that. And then, you know, as I scaled back, I'm like, you know what? You're right. As long as you have a minimum level of writing ability, like just in case, you know, like, you know, internet goes down, we lose power, you need to go to the bank. As long as you can do that, you know, at what level, at what point is, you know, what's the skill set you need in order for you to be a productive person? So with that, you know, we're better able to just adjust as a whole picture in terms of, for example, like dysgraphia. Once he was able to type, it's like, why didn't we do that earlier? You know?
In your opinion, what can educators do to foster creativity in their students when they come in with like a preconceived notion about a subject or how they're going to do in a subject based on past experiences? For example, like if your son, you know, can't write and now he's taking an art class or he's taking a history class where he has to write an essay and he's already got it in his head that I'm not going to do well because they're going to ask me to write. How can you get past that and foster some sort of creative assignment that can look past it?
Yeah, so we still face that. For him, you know, if you ask him verbally to reply to a prompt, any mm-hmm. prompt, the quality of that verbal engagement is so much higher for him. And then if you go, okay, after you told me the story, it sounds wonderful. It's very highly creative, whatever, very detailed. Mm-hmm. And then, so we did that before as an experiment and then great. So, you know, this is your prompt and this is your answer. Great. When we went home, when I asked him to transfer it to paper, even though he actually had the whole thing, the process of transferring it to write it out, he wasn't able to do it because the writing was so difficult for him. It really got in the way that he ended up writing after an hour, three sentences completely different, which fulfilled the requirements because you're supposed to write three sentences because that was in second grade, right? And not that really interesting story he really wanted to share verbally. So if you think about it, what is the purpose of the assignment? Right. If the purpose of the assignment is to answer a prompt, a mm-hmm. writing prompt, like, and here writing is it the writing part? Is the physical writing a big part of the assignment? Like, if that's the goal, then even if it's difficult, we do have to do it. But if your assignment is to either demonstrate knowledge about a material and all that, are there alternative ways for different students to demonstrate that? Like, what is the purpose and goal of each assignment and really mm-hmm. evaluate it from there. If it is a writing class, that's what we have to do, like physical writing. Let's say if the writing is for whatever reason, like a goal of the class, then even when it's difficult, then that's something we have to practice. Oftentimes that's sort of not clear. It's sort of blurred and then it gets in the way. They're not able to demonstrate really the purpose of the assignment, which is, do you know the stuff, the content? So, you know, more and more schools are, at least in the private schools, are allowing alternative ways to demonstrate knowledge. And then specifically, if it is, the purpose is the actual writing on paper, over time, for my son, once he feels comfortable that he can do it, like demonstrate his knowledge over time, he's just more open to psychologically. Before, he was very defensive because he ended up, you know, because he's already imagining all the steps in his head and he's like, no, I can't do it. But as he tasted more success, it needs to really be scaffolded. And he's like, you can do it. You know, like it's hard to go from 0 to 100. If you go from 0 to 1 or 10, depending on the child, that the scaffolding part, you know, the taste of success is a motivation by itself.
Even in terms of assessment, there should be 4 or 5 different options you know, so that it kind of reaches each student and provides an access point for each student and maybe give them a choice in how they think that they could best demonstrate their knowledge.
Yeah. And I think that choice part too, even if they end up picking what you know they would pick if you just assigned it to them, that engagement in choice psychologically, I think, makes a difference. That's qualitatively different, you know, where they feel like, oh, I'm choosing it versus my teacher says I have to do this. I think, you know, most people don't really like to be told, right, what to do. And if you have choice, and you, even if you're choosing the same option as what your teacher would, who might, you know, or your parent who says, I know you best and, you know, I know you're going to like this. When we're actively engaged and be active agents, right, in the choice, that changes the quality of the whole experience. And that's the non-tangible part that you don't see, you know.
Zen Living is a wonderful website filled with rich resources for neurodiversity. Zen Living is described as the ecology of nurturing strengths and holistic development through neuroeconomic socio-cultural dignity. Can you describe the perfect Zen-like environment that fosters that, and how can it be created at home or at school?
The purpose of Zen Living and my writings in there really is to say that in order to find your own environment, the environment that is suitable, it really needs to be individualized and customized because all of us are different. That's why you have the hyphenated, like long, you know, complicated hyphenated, like neuro, you know, bio, you know, and then it's like, it just, the list just keeps growing. The whole point is that all of those parts have to be considered all together. We tend to like focus on one aspect of it, right? Like, you know, like be it our cultural diversity or cultural, and I use the word dignity really as a common language to talk about diversity, because I think dignity, most people would all agree, yes, we all want dignity. When you talk about diversity, some people may say, no, we don't want diversity, or maybe there's, you know, some sort of standard. So dignity to me is like a bridge kind of parallel to diversity that's more palatable and more open to for more different groups of people to come to the table. Because I think trying to get different groups to come to the table is the hardest part, to be willing to come to the table to talk about how we're different, sharing our different experiences. So to create your own environment, you know, it's difficult for others to do that. It really comes from the family or the unit itself. So it's not singular. So depending on how you're considering it. So my perspective is from what is called complex dynamic systems perspective. So I really think about everything through that lens. So when I look at one person, we're not alone. Even if we're alone, we're still part of, be it a family, our community. It's that interconnectedness between all the different pieces. So in order to find that, we really have to consider, right, be considerate of and where we're at realistically. Like, you know, would I want something that's ideally without any economic constraint type of thing? Sure. But I do have economic constraints. So my options at any one moment has to be considerate of where I am and then where I would like to be. So without knowing where you are, and being really honest of where you are, it's difficult to then see where you can go, what are the options that you may have on there. Because we end up maybe focusing on the options might be on another part of this whole system when you're only focusing on a very narrow part or one or two things, because that's the most glaring, maybe most obvious thing to you. We are limiting ourselves in terms of choices and options we may overlook. So I really look at focus on not how many things I could change, but be very strategic in terms of what's the smallest tweak I can make change within a system to have a large impact. So that's how I approach things and parenting currently. So it's not about doing a lot of things, but really considering what are the small tweaks I can do that has the biggest impact, because again, we really don't know what the final impact is until it happens. So the more tweaks that you're making to a system, you don't know what the end is and you don't know what's causing what, you know, because it's just a lot of interactions. And the action doesn't have to be like, you know, I did 10 things to, you know, it's just as effective and probably also very difficult to really narrow it into what's the one or two things to do. What's the one thing I should do first? You know, like that, the prioritization, then you can see what the impact is. Because when you're doing two or three things, you don't know which one is causing what. Maybe they're canceling each other out. I don't know.
Right. And it becomes overwhelming as well. So,
yeah. Right. And you're spending all this energy doing all this, you know, 5, 10, you know, all this stuff. Right. And without, you know, if your goal is to get somewhere, then perhaps there are some other ways that we can still achieve that, that requires maybe more time. Again, it's time. It seems to be a constant theme that we need to set time for reflection before action.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Lim. It was lovely talking to you.
No problem. I really enjoyed it. And thank you for having me on your podcast. And I look forward to, you know, listening to your other episodes.
Thank you so much. C is for Curiosity is published by Archway Publishing and available on Amazon. To learn more about Dr. Lim's work and to spark wonder and inspiration, log on to zenliving.com. Thank you for listening and for being part of the Gifted Place Learning Community.